We're sponsored by ReQueered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. My guest today is Lucy Sussex, who has an interesting discussion with me about her book about a book. Plus, Justine recommends a novel by someone who is not only a great author, but also co-hosts one of our favorite podcasts. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Justine Lucy Sussex is my guest today, and she is very interesting, has some really good historical information regarding publishing and an
author named Fergus Hume.
Fergus Hume, yes, who probably most people have never heard of, but should know of. And after today, they will.
Excellent.
That's what I have coming up. What do you have today?
Well, you know, I decided that one of your guests, Christopher Rice, I had not reviewed a book by him yet, and I'm a big fan of his. And, you know, as most people know, he is the son of Anne Rice. So I went back to his very first book, A Density of Souls. It was first published in year 2000, and then he republished it in 2013 with a long afterword about its genesis and just what changes he made. You know, he had started as a short story, and then he fleshed it out, and then it went through number of edits once he got it to the publishing house. He said he did four drafts, turning up beginning to end. So he talked about what that process was like. And like last week's book, which was written before 9/11 and was similar to 9/11, in this week's book, it was written before Hurricane Katrina. And when I read the description of the hurricane that takes up a good portion of the book, I thought that it had been written after Katrina. But no, it was written before, and at some point at the beginning, they were like, well, we're taking evacuees into the Superdome. And I was like, oh, this must be based on Hurricane Katrina. No, it was not. It was written 4 years before Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, a huge portion of Chris's life was spent in New Orleans, so it's not surprising that he would have thought some of this that could happen in case of a large hurricane.
Right, right. It's interesting, in the afterword, he talks about the difference between them, that this was a river hurricane in his book, and then the Katrina hit Lake Pontchartrain, and that flooded and over hit the levee. So he spent some time talking about the difference between them. I didn't see much difference in the damage, but then I'm not intimately familiar with exactly what was going on. I just knew it was terrible.
Yeah.
And many people died. It captures New Orleans. As you say, he's lived there. It involves, the prologue is four elementary school students, but sometime I think between the fifth and sixth grade, I think it's that summer. And they're playing in a cemetery. It starts to rain. And they get frightened, and then they comfort each other, and they seem like they're going to be together forever. And then the book starts just as they're going into high school. One of the characters, Stephen, is gay, and the other three have nothing to do with him. And two of the others lead the bullying against him. So there's a large portion of the book that's in high school and involves the bullying. And as bad as it is, it's also particularly painful because these were boys that he was particularly close to just a month before school started. And then when they get to their senior year, tragedy strikes, a couple people die. And then the rest of the book deals with the aftermath of that. Along the way, there's a bombing, which is, precursor to the Pulse bombing. Chris Rice apparently had a dossier of the future and what the big events would have been. So he's thrown them all into this book. And then there's a couple of other murders along the way. Next thing you know, the alliances shift. Some people are out, other people are in, And there are a lot of secrets about who was behind some of the killings and who rescued people and prevented some other killings. And then there's a huge twist at the end, which I am not going to spoil for people. But I think people will be pleased by it.
And it's A Density of Souls.
A Density of Souls.
And what are you rating this book?
Well, you know, I kind of flipped between intriguing and thrilling and glowing. I think I'm going with a glowing recommendation. It's incredibly well written.
Glowing. I think this is the one Christopher was surprised it didn't do as well as he had expected. He was let down because he likes this book.
I don't know. It was his first book, so I'm not sure that I thought he had... His third book was it. Well,
you know what? You're right. If this was his first, okay. If this was his first book, it did really well. It was a New York Times bestseller.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it would have gotten, you know, raked over the coals if it was awful.
That is true. That is very true. So I'm a big fan of Christopher Rice. I recommend people go back and listen to when he was a guest on the show. He was on episode number 49. Justine and I are a huge fan of his podcast. He and his best friend, Eric, have a podcast called Christopher and Eric, which is easy to remember. And Justine is such a fan of the show that on the Christopher and Eric Facebook page, she is like one of the top fans on there. You see, she posts on almost everything they post. She responds. And she is well known on that page.
I don't know if I'm well known. I mean, Facebook has these algorithms that slaps that badge on you, but I'm always surprised that I'm one of their top fans because it always seems that there's a lot of people on there. But apparently the algorithm says I'm it.
You are. I read it all the time, but you post all the time. So yeah. I see you on there a lot. So yeah, it's a great show, Christopher and Eric. I'm even going to put the link in the show notes. And again, the name of the book is A Density of Souls by Christopher Rice. And Justine gives it a glowing recommendation.
Yep. People should read it. I think that's it. You know, we have Lev Rapio's fourth Nick Hoffman book coming out in next week. And so people should get on that pre-order.
Wonderful. Well, Lucy Sussex is coming up. Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, queerwritersofcrime.com. Lucy Sussex is with me here today. Welcome, Lucy.
Delighted to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. And before your intro, I want to give a little explanation to our listeners that we're going to be on a different ride today. And it's something I find fascinating. We're going to talk about a book by an author about an author. And North and South Magazine put it very well that Lucy Sussex's book is a very interesting whodunit about a whodunit. And that's the little teaser I'm going to give you.
That's very good.
Did you not read that before?
I'd not heard of it. It's great.
It's perfect definition of what we're going to discuss. Lucy will be discussing a crime novel, The Mystery of a Hansom Cab, that most crime readers have not heard of. And it's written by Fergus Hume, a mystery writer that most today haven't heard of. My assumption is most have not heard of it. And another quote comes from Publishers Weekly, which says, "Who now cares about Fergus Hume? Sussex's fascinating book reveals why all crime fiction readers should." And I think that is very well put as well. And then as we get into our discussion, they're going to learn why they should know about Fergus and this novel. So your formal introduction is, a New Zealander-born writer living in Australia, Lucy's award-winning work covers many genres, from children's books to horror. She began in science fiction. In 2015, she published the prize-winning blockbuster about Fergus Hume's 1886 The Mystery of a Hansom Cab, the biggest-selling detective novel of the 1800s. And again, I want to make it clear, we're going to be discussing two books here. We're going to be discussing The Murder of a Hansom Cab, which was by Fergus Hume, published in 1886. And then we're going to be primarily talking about Blockbuster, which is Lucy's book about the novel and its author. I hope I've made that clear. Did I, Lucy?
You did.
Okay. And I want to tell you, when you first contacted me and you brought up the fact that there is some evidence that Fergus Hume was gay, I was a little bit skeptical because there's this trend now that people, and I'm sure you're aware, people will look at old letters and they see a man will write to another man during that time period and tell him of his undying love to him, which was a common thing done at that time. And it's misconstrued now because we tend to only have one word for love. And I think the Greeks do it really well. They have different words for love, one for romantic love, one for your love of your parents, one for your love of your children, sexual love, and a love for a car, where we kind of have it all lumped in together. And so I think when people hear these old letters where, you know, a man tells his best friend, I love you dearly and always have, we get this report in gay magazines or whatever that such and such was definitely gay. And that's not always the truth. So when you first contacted me, I was skeptical. But then you showed me a lot of background and you have some pretty overwhelming evidence that it seems unlikely he wasn't gay.
Well, I was researching the history of the book because it's a fascinating aspect of crime fiction history, and queer history is not an area that I'd worked in. And had I but known it was so incredibly difficult to work in because the evidence is either hidden or coded. Mm-hmm. I really wonder whether I would have persisted. But as I was working on the book, I met Curtis Evans, who has interests in that area, and a couple of other people. And after three people, after Curtis and two others had asked me if Hume was gay, I thought, I've really got to look into this. And there were hints of it. There was an article published by Jeremy Parrott, who's a book historian, which talked about Fergus Hume in his later years having a male companion. And again, that could mean anything in those days. It was not significant. Mm-hmm. But it had information from a woman who was named as Mary Dalton, actually Maisie Dalton, who's a cousin of Fergus Hume. And when I contacted Maisie, she contacted me eventually, we both realised that the same thing had struck us. And that was a book by Fergus published in the early 1890s called The Island of Fantasy, which is quite amazingly homoerotic. It is full of suppressed desire for the male body from Grecian friezes. And then there was a lot of supporting evidence. He wrote a poem called Venus Urania, and Urania was one of these code words which was used by Oscar Wilde to signify the love of men. It derives from the ancient Greeks, and it's regarded to be a higher form of love. And in fact, there was a whole bunch of poets in England in the 19th century who were same-sex identified, and they were called the Uranian poets. So there was a lot of supporting evidence, but I had to write Blockbuster and I couldn't actually pin it down. The most definitive thing was that Fergus had given £20, which was then a large amount of money, to a young man called Gordon Lawrence. And Gordon Lawrence became famous for being arrested for soliciting in drag. He's the most famous gay in 19th century Melbourne, where I live. And he was arrested by the police, and he was wearing a bustle, which is, you know, and corsets and everything. And the police grabbed him, and thinking that he was a woman of the night, and his wig fell off, and there was short hair, and so he was tried and sent to a jail, which is about a mile away from me, and that Fergus Hume gave him £20 suggested, because this was an era where gay blackmail was huge. So I went to Kerry Greenwood, who writes the Phryne Fisher mysteries that you might have seen on TV. And Kerry is a lawyer as well as a crime writer. And I said, Kerry, what do you make of this? And she said, well, it has to be either infatuation or blackmail. That's a lot of money. And it was, and it, blackmail was rife. And, but again, I couldn't prove it until, as it happened, 6 months after the book, I put all the possibilities. And then 6 months after the book was out, I did find the proof and I got it, but I got into the newspapers just in time for the Sydney Mardi Gras, which was not the better timing than I could have hoped for under the circumstances.
I want to say, having read the book and read your book, the fact that he was gay is actually secondary to me because of his influence in crime fiction, really, is what I find most important, gay or straight. And I do want to talk a little bit about that. But first, I've seen you referred to, and I don't know if you referred to it as yourself or others have, as a literary archaeologist.
Oh.
What does that mean?
A while back, I had a dream job. I was working for a professor, Stephen Knight, who was primarily a medievalist, and I was his researcher. And he was writing a history of crime fiction in Australia. So I had the beautiful job of going to the rare book section of the library and reading, being paid to read. And I would say, yes, this is crime, because it always, or wasn't always clear that something was crime, or mm-hmm. this is really good. And so I discovered I had a passion for researching in this area because particularly early women writers, because they'd been pretty much forgotten, and that was the first time I heard Fergus Hume. And Stephen Knight said even then there's something very odd about the story about how this book was produced. It sounds dodgy. Really, I'm not quite sure what the US term would be, a really shifty character. And Stephen, as it happened, was absolutely right. So I got a fascination with looking up obscure aspects of crime history, and eventually I did a PhD on the early women writers of crime, the mothers of the mystery genre. And I'm still at it. I'm finishing a biography at the moment of Mary Fortune, who was a very early police procedural. So I got interested in this aspect of looking at writers' lives and discovering that they were more complex and interesting and sometimes far out people than you would imagine. But at the time, I had no idea that Fergus Hume and the story of the book was quite so interesting.
And I'm going to hazard a guess. You've written 6 novels yourself and over 30 short stories. But I could be wrong here. I get a feeling your greater passion is digging into the lives of authors and other stories. Is that fair?
Not necessarily, because I'm interested in true crime as well. But I'm interested in hidden stories. And even if this means I go down rabbit holes, mm-hmm. with incredible a lot. It's incredible. It's real fun. It's real fun to research.
So that's really what it comes down to. So many mystery writers and obviously true crime writers, a lot of research is involved, and it is very easy to get lost in that. My stories take place in LA, and I dig so much information from LA past, and I'm like, how do I make this all fit in the novel? And I can't 99% of it, but I sure wish I could, because I could just do that all day and not write anything because I get so involved in the research. So I understand where that comes from. Let's get to the core, starting with The Mystery of a Hansom Cab. Just give us a quick idea of the plot of the story, and then we can talk about Hume and what happened with that book.
Okay. Well, it begins with a cabman driving a hansom cab, which you would have seen in Sherlock Holmes films. It's a very upright cab with the driver actually outside and at the back of the cab. So he can't actually see what's going on inside the cab. So it's a cab driver who's driving a couple of men home. One gets out, he carries on with the other one, and when he gets to the destination, he finds the man inside is dead. He's been chloroformed, and the handkerchief with the chloroform is still over his nose. So he goes to the police. Nobody knows who the guy is. He's in evening dress. So it's some time before they discover who he is and identify him. And then the question is, who killed him and why? And this is a story which goes from the high society of a colonial city, which was then the biggest city, biggest and richest city in the Southern Hemisphere, down to the slums, and it's essentially a story about people emigrating to a different place and leaving their past lives behind, and then it comes back and bites them in the bum, to use a somewhat vulgar expression, but it would be the American one. So it's about hidden secrets and how they can emerge, and then goes right through a trial. A man is wrongly accused. He's close to being hanged, and then evidence emerged at the last minute, but it's still not enough to completely clear him. And at the end, you have the mystery revealed, what it's really about. So it's a classic mystery story. It begins with a death investigation, in this case by two detectives and a bunch of amateurs, rather than the Sherlockian detective as hero. And then you get to the end and court case, and then all is resolved. And it's got a lot of local colour, it's got a lot of drama, and it was filmed about three times in the silent era. And there was a telemovie in 2012, which is available. I'm not quite sure how compatible it is, but it's an interesting dramatization.
I had mixed feelings when I read the book, because on the one hand, I felt like, you know, this isn't all that great of a story. But a lot of it was written based on the time it was written, where today readers like to get much more involved and interested into the sleuth's life. And back then, they knew a little bit about Sherlock Holmes, but mainly people wanted to know more. They wanted the puzzle. How did the pieces fit together, and how do we solve it? So that tended to be more the focus. For example, one of the things surprised me right at the very beginning, before anyone knew the person was dead in the hansom cab, the author kept referring to him as the deceased. And it confused me at times. I'm like, well, they haven't said that they found a dead body. Why are they referring to him as the deceased? And for the most part, he was letting the reader know that while people were going about doing their things, this body in the hansom cab was a dead body. And then eventually they discovered the deceased. So I found that kind of odd, whereas nowadays I think it would have been written that it would have been a shock. Oh, you know, you open up the door and the body falls out, and there it is. So it was a much different style. So I say on the one hand, I don't think it was all that well written. On the other hand, it did paint a great picture of that era. It was written about almost 20 years after Dickens died, and I found a lot of Dickens-esque into it, for sure. And I know that this was published the same year as Arthur Conan Doyle's first novel. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, it actually slightly preceded it. And you see, both of them were just at the start of the real commercialization, when the genre of detective fiction really starts to take off. But their products, they're both pieces, they were actually born about less than 2 months apart. And Doyle was very slightly the older, and they were both shipping their work around to London publishers at the same time, and one particular publisher rejected both of them, he must have been cursing him until the end of his days. So they were competing with each other but didn't know it. But they were both were Hume was enormously successful when he was published, and Doyle was less successful. A Study in the Scarlet really didn't get anywhere when he eventually accepted a rather poor deal to publish it. And it was only after The Mystery of the Hansom Cab became enormously commercially successful all around the world, that Doyle was approached and by the Strand magazine, who said, "We think you should write more of these stories with Sherlock Holmes." So Doyle was very jealous of Hume and its success, and he didn't like the Hansom Cab at all. He thought it was piffle. Puffery, which is means that it was overhyped, which was perfectly true, as mm-hmm. as it turns out, a deliberate strategy. But it created the market for Sherlock Holmes. It made publishers sit up and say, "Oh my God, we can really make money here," and so it paved the success for Doyle. And indeed, Hume went on to write 140 novels. So he had quite a long career, dying in the 1930s. And Doyle, of course, everybody knows about Doyle. You know, he's still going very strong.
Yeah, but the impact that this novel, that, as I said, I don't believe most people have ever heard of, is astounding, because it was such a huge, huge success. And it's such an odd story, that the way that happened. First of all, Hume was he didn't necessarily want to be a mystery writer or even a novelist. He was more interested in theater, correct?
Yeah, he wanted to be a dramatist. He was passionately interested in the theater, and he was a very theatrical person. And he came to Melbourne, which was then from New Zealand, which was, so he was going to the Big Smoke, but he couldn't break into the theater industry. So he had the idea of writing a novel to get him, basically to get more attention. And so he thought, well, what sort of novel should I write? So went to a bookseller and said, "What's selling?" And they said, "Gaboriau." Now, Gaboriau is not particularly well known now, but he was a French writer who wrote about 14 police procedurals. And in the 1880s, they started to be translated into English. And they were very successful, and it's the word detective fiction as referring to a genre starts to be used with reference to Gaboriau's work. So Hume buys all Gaboriau, takes them home, reads them, thinks, "What can I learn from this? Okay, write a murder mystery which is very strongly set in place." So he goes, because he's working as a lawyer's clerk, he's got access to the law system. He can go into the slums. He can go into high society. So he plots the story as in a very classical, he plots it before writing a word. He sits down and writes it. Then he looks at it at the end and says, "My God, the murder is too obvious." So he sits down and rewrites it again with a less obvious murderer. So he's really done his homework, and he's worked very hard. But the trouble is, he finds that when the publishing industry, the local publishing industry is very small, and the first publisher he goes to is a Scots Presbyterian who thinks it's immoral because it's got bad language like damn. And also Hume, who's a little bit mischievous, has gone and set the opening scenes of the novel near the Scots Presbyterian church, which this particular publisher happened to worship. And so he had limited options there. And he sends it overseas. It gets rejected. He sends it to England, which means you've got to wait because for the steamships to get there and back. So it gets into the hands of a man who's a bit of a chancer called Fred Trischler. And Fred has worked in the US. He's been in the publishing industry. He's come back originally English, and he's been on the west coast of the US. He really wants to get rich, and he thinks he can do it by publishing. And Fred Trischler comes across the manuscript of The Hansom Cab, which is floating around publishing people. And he sits down and reads it, and he can't go to sleep all night. And then he goes, "My God, we've got it. You know, this is fabulous. We've got to publish it." So he goes to Hume and says, "We've got to publish this." But the thing is, they're not really a publishing company, and you actually need a bit of money to produce the book. So there's enough in Hume's books about Melbourne, there's enough about mining speculation, and he knew a major mining speculator, a woman called Alice Cornwall, that to suggest that they just speculated on mining on the share market until they had enough money, because they both told the story that they raised the money from speculating in shares. And when they had enough money, they went to a printer who took their money and produced the book, which is now an extremely rare item. They printed an edition, they said, of some thousand stories, some thousand copies, 5,000. That's been queried by book historians, but there's only four copies known surviving. So if you ever come across a copy of the first edition, it's worth a lot of money, as in five figures. And they publish it in locally in the Australian colonies, which includes New Zealand, and it takes off like a rocket. They create a word-of-mouth phenomenon. My feeling is that they probably plastered, had enough money to put little posters on every lamppost, and Hume, as a publicity stunt, got into a hansom cab and delivered the books to all the booksellers in the city, which was cute. I wanted, when I was doing Blockbuster, I said, "Couldn't we do this?" And the publicist at my publisher, Tex, said, "The press is not really keen on stunts these days, and it would cost money." So, drat, couldn't do it. And also, they were selling it on the day of the biggest race in the colonies, which is the Melbourne Cup, where the population of the city surged with people, and there's evidence they were actually selling it at the racecourse. So a whole lot of people, and this was a really big reading city at the time, picked up copies of the book, and the first edition, whatever its size, sold out very quickly. And then they had a problem in that the demand was big, but because you typeset by hand, the type had been distributed, so they didn't have stereotypes, which was copy. They couldn't simply print again using the old-fashioned printing machine, so they had to wait and set it again. And they did something like three editions, which also sold well locally. And at the end of it, Fred Trischler thinks, "Well, hold on, I think this is going to do well in England if I can get it to England." So this time he takes a plaster mold of the printing blocks, which you could do at that. It's where the word stereotyping comes from. And he pays £50 to Hume for the copyright. And Hume, who's, well, you've got to say people see Hume coming. He's not a businessman. And he thinks it's going to not work overseas because it's set in a city on the other side of the world from England. So he thinks it's not going to work. So he takes his £50. Hume, what he still wants to do is become a dramatist. So it's not helped that during this time he gets blackmailed as well, but never mind. But anyway, so Fred Trischler sails to England. He's raised some money from a banker who, it turns out, is also rather dodgy. And this banker has been stealing from his clients, but they don't know that for a number of years. And so Fred Trischler takes the steamer to England. He's got money from the banker, and he basically sets up a printing press and prints thousands of copies of the book. At the same time, he puts advertorials for the hansom cab in just about every newspaper in the United Kingdom. So he piques people's interests. He gets into railway bookstalls so that people see it when they're getting onto a train and they need some reading matter. What his selling point is, it's been extraordinarily successful in the colonies now, and you know, you should really read this book because it's sold thousands and thousands of copies already. And of course, it's successful because it's successful. People really want to read it, and because it's cheap. It's a shilling, mm-hmm. which is like a dime novel, which was the US equivalent. And so people are reading it because they're curious, and then they recommend it to their friends because crime fiction is piquing people's interests at the time. And it's not so long, it's only a few months since there's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which was sold in exactly the same fashion, a cheap edition from sold at bookstores, which took, and so people are really interested in these paper covered novels. There are so many editions of The Hansom Cab. It was translated into all sorts of European languages. It was translated into Chinese. Still a recent Chinese edition because it depicts Chinese in Melbourne. It's possibly the first worldwide crime phenomenon. And so it sells, within a period of months, approximately 500,000 copies. So it's the biggest selling and the fastest selling crime novel of the 1800s.
It's amazing that many copies and Hume only got 50 pounds.
He was cursing it for the end. He was, in fact, when he came to England to make it as a dramatist, this was a real selling point. This was a publicity point for him that he'd sold the copyright for 50 pounds, but he had every anticipation of building on the success to be a dramatist. But as it happened, it was his books that were more successful, and and he could never really break into the drama market. And in fact, he might have been quite a successful dramatist. He was certainly really good at dialogue, and these days I reckon he'd be a Hollywood script writer. I think the Melia would have suited him very well, but the public just wanted more crime stories for him. And so he went on writing them, 140. And he tried other genres like Island of Fantasy, which was about an imaginary colony on a Greek island, complete with volcano. He tried writing science fiction. He tried writing for children. But really, because he had a legal background, he was best suited to be a crime writer. I think that was where all his skills are. And some of his books are pulp and some of them are very, very good. The Mystery of a Hansom Cab is still in print. It's still regarded as a very good guide to the 19th century city. And in fact, they're now being reprinted in e-edition by Matt Lubbers-Morin, who's basically set it, his mission is to bring them all into print again, which is an initiative I really applaud.
When I said earlier that it didn't seem like the best of books that I've read, it was actually the dramatist side of it that struck me that way, because it did read very much like a script to me, like a playwright had written the novel, not necessarily exactly a script, but similar in that sense. Now, this type of advertising that was done, or promotion that was done, you said between this and actually Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I'm guessing that was new, and I would presume that would have been considered very vulgar in the publishing industry at that time.
Well, Hume did try, but he never really got out of the... crime fiction was really disreputable, except for the American writer Anna Katharine Green. And Conan Doyle was certainly not afforded the respect that he has now. So yeah, it was pulpy. It was considered disreputable because it was inciting people to commit sins. That was one of the Christian attitudes. But Anna Katharine Green was a religious woman, and she was much more respectable. But mostly, it just had that little whiff of, and also, yeah, it was, police were considered a bit lower class as well if you were writing about the police. And you can see that in the Golden Age mysteries, the snobbery with violence, it's called. And it also in Doyle, because Sherlock Holmes is much, you know, is bigger and smart, is much smarter than Lestrade, but even though he's an amateur. So you don't have the police procedural, the fascination that you do with this, that you do now. And I think Hume felt a bit of it himself, which is why he made a very crucial mistake in that he didn't have a series detective at first.
Mm-hmm.
He came across it later, but by that stage, Doyle was very much established, and it was a sense that Hume was the hare and Doyle was the tortoise, and then Doyle got onto a roller skate and he took off. And Hume could never compete with him again.
What I'm curious is, and maybe you can answer this for me, is there was a lot of publicity about this book, which is clearly part of its huge success. But it wouldn't have happened if there wasn't this big desire for crime stories at that era. And then we saw Doyle take off and everything else. Why do you think it was at that time there was a sudden interest in crime stories?
You can actually trace it. I mean, it's a very human trait. And in my book, I started to look at the origins. It's first with true crime. You get the Newgate Calendar, which was supposedly the confessions of people who were hanged at Newgate Calendar, and that was in the sort of the 1700s. But people were absolutely mad for crime coverage in the newspapers. They'd buy the newspapers continually to see if there was any progress on, you know, this murder, this woman who'd been chopped up and thrown into the Thames. Had they found the torso yet? There was a real morbid fascination, and when they couldn't get true crime, they started reading crime. It was all over the place. You couldn't get away with it. Dickens went to public hangings and he was disgusted by them. You could get broadside murder ballads in the street. There was a lot of it in the theatre. In particular, they were fascinated by motive. They wanted to know why people did things. They knew perfectly well that it couldn't be the devil that inspired people to crime. And so you can see that also in The Ripper, the continuing fascination then and now with the Jack the Ripper murders. People don't change. Crime is something people are fascinated with, unless perhaps, say, they're the victim of it, then they're not quite as interested.
Of course not. The grittiness of the novel, was that something that attracted people as well, dealing with the slums and brothels and things of that nature? Was that enticing to people at that time?
Oh, yes, that was very, very naughty. The opium dens. And Hume was just telling it as he saw it. He was being completely honest, because in any of the big cities around the world, you would have got exactly the same scenes. They've done excavations on their slum areas in Melbourne, and they've actually so you could go into a display case in one of the big buildings of the things they've dug up, and they include condoms, and not condoms, but the remains of contraceptive devices they've found. And people are still fascinated as to what those slums were like. And you could go and do tours with them. It was a really seedy place. And he walked right through those slums researching.
You said three people asked you if he was gay, and that's when you kind of started looking into it. I'm curious, what, pray tell, led them to ask you that question?
Curtis Evans said something like it was Hume's liquid eyes, which I think was Curtis being facetious. Chris Wallace Crabbe, who's a poet, he knew about the Iranians, so it was the word Venus Urania, which he spotted that immediately, that it's a code word. And the third one was a biographer of Madame Midas. This was the financier, Alice Cornwell, who probably helped finance the Mystery of the Hansom Cab by providing stock market. And the biographer said, well, he never married, but when nobody ever mentions him having a sweetheart, but he's always associated with older, powerful women. And she thought the relationship in between Hume, that was the notion of the relationship. I was a little bit dubious until I came to the Island of Fantasy, and then I went, oh my God. And I read it aloud to another Victorianist, an expert in the era, and she said, stop, Lucy, you've proved the point. It really is that obvious. And then there was the story of Gordon Lawrence, and the more you look into it, you could see that there were these hints and the blackmail story by the time that I got the details on that. Would you like me to go more into the blackmail story?
Certainly. I love a good blackmail story.
Okay. This one's, yeah. Okay, well, the thing was, in the 19th century, men were charged with sodomy, which could refer to, it could refer to sex with animals, and it could refer to sex between men. But it was quite hard to prove because, on the whole, you had to catch somebody in the act. That didn't mean that men who were caught soliciting in drag weren't tried for it. There was one in the 1860s here who was chased by the police and actually fought them off quite successfully for a while. He was sentenced to hang but then reprieved. So it could happen, but on the whole, until this British MP called Labouchere brought an amendment which essentially criminalised all same-sex activity between men, and that could include sex acts, but of course there could be evidence like the like compromising letters. And so the low-life rent boys suddenly realised that they had an extra source of income. They could not only sell their bodies, but they could also sell the evidence. And people would pay up, and Oscar Wilde paid up prior to his court case. But there wasn't much evidence of it happening in Australia at the time. And given Hume had some association with Gordon Lawrence, I didn't know what it was, but that Gordon Lawrence had been arrested for soliciting a drag and given a small prison sentence and then released and then disappeared. I think changed his name, and as was quite common, as queer historians have found, you just changed your name and go to another country, and people, it's much harder to track people.
Yeah, not so easy to do nowadays.
Well, yeah, we're all, you know, use TikTok, Google, we've all got our footprints. But so about 6 months after the book was published, and when I'd had to say, look, I can't be certain, there's a lot of evidence, but I wouldn't call it completely conclusive, I came across an article, and it was talking about Hume being blackmailed, and it said that he had been, this is from the early 1900s, and it said that Hume had been blackmailed in Sydney and it named the theatre by a black Shakespearean actor. And I thought, interesting, because at that time there weren't that many actors who were black in the theatre, and they'd be used in productions like Uncle Tom's Cabin, when the Harriet Beecher Stowe novel, instead of using white actors in blackface. So they found work there. And so they weren't completely unknown. They could be quite successful. And I thought, the Criterion Theatre, that's in Sydney, how do I find this man? And I looked to what was going, and I found that same time there was a production in theatre in Sydney of a play that was about a rebellion in the slave rebellion in the West Indies, and the lead actor was a man called Antoine Bollars, who'd come from the West Indies by England, where he'd worked in the theatre as a dresser, and he'd come out to Australia, and he'd got the lead role, and in fact he performed very credibly in it, and he was quite good at it. But again, he was a little bit dodgy, and so I thought, what can I find out about this man now that I have his name? And I thought, let's try newspaper records and let's see if he turns up in prison. And yes, newspaper records. I found him only a few months before George Lawrence was arrested for soliciting in drag. Antoine Bollars was, I can only say, it was cruising the streets of Melbourne, and picked up a young man, took him back to his lodgings. Something happened there between the two of them, but the young man had lost his diamond tie pin, which had been given to him by his father. And how do you lose a diamond tie pin? Well, you take your tie off. But he'd lost a valuable item of jewellery, so he went to the police. Initially, he was reporting a robbery, then questions were asked. And though it didn't appear in the paper, there was a court case, and Antoine Bollers was charged and found guilty and sent to prison. What had happened was that Bollers was quite likely, it was consensual, and there was probably payment, but because it came to the attention of the police, they went after Bollers, and there weren't that many Afro-Jamaican people in Melbourne at the time, so he was arrested and found guilty. He was flogged, and he was given a heavier jail sentence than Gordon Lawrence, because the charge was indecent assault on a male person. And so I could look at his prison record, and though it wasn't in the papers, it was in the prison record, so I knew why he was there, and I could speculate that the other thing was there were two people involved in the blackmail of Hume. One was Gordon Lawrence, one was Bollers. They were acting in concert, or whether it was compromising letters or what, I can't be certain. But as I said, Bollers went to jail, came out, and thereafter he was in and out of the prison system, not for any further homosexual acts, but criminalised acts, but for things like, theft. So he disappeared into the criminal underclass. But he's a really interesting character, and I'd like to do more work on him one of these days.
I think you could write a whole book on that whole topic in general from that era.
Yes, there's so much research that could be done, but I'm not going to get in the way of, I'm a het gal. I'm not going to get in the way of any queer historians, because it's not really my area. Mm-hmm. But I will make my research available to anybody who's researching in that area. My interest was simply that it's intersection with Hume. It's a story that needs to be told, that there were so many people in that time. I've got another case which I'm putting into the book I'm researching, but as I said, I don't want to infringe on anybody else who wants to write the story, who feels they have a personal stake.
Well, I don't know if that is necessary, but I think that I'm sure there are plenty of people that are chomping at the bit to write that story, so I don't think that's going to be an issue at all. The original novel that we're talking about is The Mystery of a Hansom Cab, written by Fergus Hume, and that came out in 1886. And it's pretty much available anywhere. It's all over on Amazon. There are free audiobooks by literary societies on YouTube. I did look and saw that the 2012 film adaptation is available for Amazon Prime members for free. But what you really want to read is Blockbuster by Lucy Sussex.
Thank you.
I am not one to read many nonfiction novels, and there's no reason other than I just get myself engrossed in fiction novels. But when Lucy contacted me, I read the book and found it. You don't even need to read Mystery of the Hansom Cab. Just the whole story behind the publishing of the novel and its huge success and Fergus Hume's life, it was fascinating.
And if you want to know the full story about Antoine Bollers and his involvement with Hume, the evidence came out just as this book, Curtis Evans' Murder in the Closet, came out. And I won't say we stopped the presses, but I had to work very quickly to revise my essay in this book, which is about Hume, to incorporate that evidence. So Curtis Evans's book was shortlisted for a non-fiction Edgar Award, and is very much out there too.
And you won some awards with Blockbuster, is that correct?
Yes, I won a history award for writing history, and actually got some money for it, which was nice.
Good.
And I was shortlisted in New Zealand because I'm a New Zealander by birth and inclination, although I live in Australia, and I'm citizens of both Australia and New Zealand. But It was shortlisted for the Nia Marsh Award, and Nia Marsh was a queen of the Golden Age, still very readable now. She's been, and it was decided that New Zealand should have crime awards, and so they got together, including a man called Craig Sisterson, who's a big promoter of crime fiction from this part of the world, and so they decided they'd have the Nia Marsh Awards, and after that, New Zealand crime fiction has been going gangbusters. So I didn't win, but I was shortlisted, and thereafter went to the first New Zealand crime fiction convention and had an enormous fun meeting the New Zealand crime fiction community and some of the Australians I hadn't met too.
If you are a crime fiction reader, regardless of whether it's LGBTQ or straight or both, it doesn't matter. This book really talks about the beginning of crime fiction becoming a big thing. I think you'll find it interesting.
And one other thing I'll just add, it just shows that you can self-publish a book and it can take over the world.
That is true. That is true. It's funny that they were able to do that before Amazon existed.
Absolutely. But I would say, advice, never sell your copy by it.
I would agree with you 100% there. If you don't learn anything else from you, learn that. Well, Lucy, thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on today.
It's been wonderful. So, farewell from the other side of the world.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.